This is Monocle on Design, and I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
It's very free because there's a lack of budget. Usually, it means that clients and architects, we're all free to experiment, so there's no inhibitions.
We head to Athens to find out how architects, designers, and entrepreneurs in the cash-strapped country are turning the tide. Plus, a look at the past and future of British mosque design with the author of a book chronicling them and a man who's designed one himself. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Now, Greece has been grabbing headlines of late, and not just because it's summer. In less than a month's time, the country will be exiting its third and final bailout programme, ending 8 years of austerity, on paper at least. This show's producer, a Hellene herself, tripped back to her hometown of Athens to speak to some of the young architects and designers who weathered the storm and turned the opportunity that comes with tight commissions and creative problem-solving to their advantage. Daphne Karnizis reports.
Greece is preparing to exit its final bailout programme in less than a month, the third tranche of financial aid given by the Eurozone in exchange for specific social and economic reforms. It's been 9 years since the start of the country's debt crisis, and life for the ordinary Greek is still unquestionably difficult. Taxes are particularly crippling. Recent figures show that the average Greek works 198 days a year just to pay their annual taxes. On a recent visit to my hometown of Athens, though, things seem to look up. There was a quiet understanding that things are slowly gearing up again, and for those willing to look a little closer, even an air of excitement. As with most economic crises, one of the first sectors that's hardest hit was construction. Large architecture and design studios that had for years established themselves as top names found themselves winding up, or at least downsizing, as people became reluctant to build or renovate their homes or begin any sort of entrepreneurial activity. Those that have weathered the storm seem to be the younger, less experienced, eager but flexible architects and designers that are breathing a new dynamism into the country's hotels, restaurants and entertainment spots. I hopped on the 3-hour flight to Athens to speak to some of the young practices turning things in the cash-strapped country to their favour. On the shady foothills of Lycabettus Hill, which offers one of the best views in the city, the 80s-built concrete office of K Studio offered welcome relief from the 37-degree morning heat. The Athens-based architecture and interior design studio was started in 2010 by brothers Dimitris and Konstantinos Karambatakis.
Hi, I'm Dimitris Karambatakis. I'm a co-founder of K Studio. So the building was developed in early 80s by a groundwork company. And by the early 2010s, it was all empty. So we moved in on the second floor. And as business grew, we occupied more floors. It's a very good spot where it sits between the Lycabettus Hill, which is an amazing expanse of almost wild forest. It has an amazing overview of the city that it sits above and in great proximity to the area of Neapoli, which is just below us, and then further down Exarchia, which has all the cool places to go after work. And on the other side, it goes down to Kolonaki, which again has good places to eat and shop. It's very convenient because I live very close. So I walk on the ring road of the hill for 10 minutes, and that's the main reason I love it. We both studied in London and worked in London for Will Alsop. That was back in early 2000s, and we had a plan to just stay there. A friend trusted us early on and wanted us to develop a house for him. It was a big decision to come to Athens back in 2004 and just set up. We did that by ourselves, and then that went well. Another friend trusted us, and trust just kept on growing through friends and connections up to the point that 5 years on, there was a key project that helped us kind of break over the ring of friendship and into the market. Now we are 15 years working, where the studio has grown.
While the founders are architects, the 52-person strong team describe themselves as a design studio and aren't afraid to test out different areas.
We are working on architecture, interior, landscape, and we're also kind of tapping our way into branding, trying to create an umbrella above these disciplines in order to tell holistic stories, not just to do design. So we're more trying to create identities.
When it comes to its clients, though, the studio has carefully crafted a niche for itself in the fields of entertainment, hospitality, and leisure in Greece and abroad. While Greeks may still be reluctant to spend on renovating their home or building a new one, recent years have seen an explosion of food and drink offerings in the capital.
Our connecting thread is leisure. We develop projects that have to do with people having fun in them while they're in. So this could be, at the moment, anything from a small bistro of 70 square meters that we just completed down in Kolonaki area with amazing croissants, amazing pastries. It's called Queen Bee. And we are working on a project right now. It's called Perianth. It's an old building from the 1930s in the center of Athens in Plateia Agios Irinis, Agia Irinis Square. And it's got rooms and a bistro on the ground floor, a spa. It's quite an urban response to the building and to the area. We have been appointed with Betaplan, another architectural studio, and we're working now. We just got planning for the new airport in Mykonos. So it's quite a challenge for us to work on a different typology, but again, we approach it as a leisure project. We think Mykonos doesn't need an airport that's processing you in the same way. It's a small airport, doesn't have that many planes landing there relative to much larger airports. So it's a place of leisure, and that has allowed us to kind of expand our experience.
So how did they manage to weather the storm when so many others buckled under the pressure?
People, investors during the crisis were looking for value for money practices that could have enough knowledge and enough excitement and enthusiasm, but also could be easy to kind of work with. So we really benefited from that. And as the economic situation has now turned over with hospitality and a flood of investment in tourism, we found ourselves again just riding another wave, which has been quite exciting.
Headlines over the years have talked about the Greek brain drain, the talented youth seeking employment and a life overseas. So despite the difficulties, what still makes Athens a great place for architects and designers?
One is the people. People are very easy to talk to and very easy to get around a table all together. And we really believe that design is a cross-disciplinary conversation that involves a lot of people around a table and that brainstorm a lot. In Athens, this is more easy than other cities. People are more available because of culture, because of the way that the market is set up. So we have benefited a lot from having a cross-disciplinary team straight from the beginning of a project where you can develop things quite deeply with other designers and other consultants. The city itself has so many layers, historic, cultural, more contemporary. It's an amalgam of design things and stuff that have happened. So there's a lot of chaos as well, which is quite inspiring always. I think you can, you know, zoom in and out to many different things. So I think that is also very inspiring. Athens is a multi-layered city throughout the years, the ages. You know, you've got all these different palimpsest moments where a Byzantine church can just pop through the kind of more contemporary urban fabric, and then a new building like the Niarchos Foundation building can really change a whole area.
On the other side of town, in the sleepy by day, vibrant by night residential neighbourhood of Petralona, the founder of architecture practice Point Supreme, Kostadinos Padazis, agrees.
I think it's a tough time financially speaking, but it's an amazing time in every other respect. It's very exciting. It's very free. So because basically there's a lack of budget, usually, it means that clients and architects, we're all free to experiment. So there's no inhibitions, there's no demands on other aspects that you would normally find yourself trapped in. So if you can be inventive and improvisational enough, you can get to greater results.
Badaziz founded Point Supreme with partner Mariana Redu in 2008 with a surrealist edge and use of vibrant colours in their projects.
I'm Mariana Redu, I'm an architect, co-founder of Point Supreme.
Our office started exactly 10 years ago. We were at the time in Rotterdam working for other big offices, but we started to do our own little projects and ideas for Athens. So soon after, we moved our office here back to Greece, and it's been very exciting since because there's so many things to do here. There's so much potential. There's so many ideas we have for the city. So we try to put all those into our work. It's an amazing area. So Petralona, it's right under the foot of the Acropolis, right besides Philopappou Hill in the center of Athens. And it's a slightly underdeveloped area because it's uphill, basically, and it's not allowed to build high. So the area is full of old little low housing units. So it's a little bit old school Athens. It's a bit like a neighborhood from the beginning of the century. It's very quiet. So when we discovered this area very recently and started to rent a small apartment here, we were so excited. We realized we could walk everywhere. We stopped taking a car to most places. So soon after, we found a derelict house and bought it and turned it into our own house. And also we rented this shop, which became our little office. And so we've been here for 5 or 6 years, and we keep being as excited as we were in the first moment where we first visited.
At the same time, we are working on the big project of Marseille, the New Architecture School of Marseille, that we do it with some friends, collaborators, which is this image is here. You can see the courtyards that are very essential for this project. And we have a commission in Netherlands, in Amersfoort, for a restaurant building. It's an autonomous building next to the river. It has been a bit of a struggle for us because we are trying to do something that merge the traditional brick houses with a new typology.
It's a very exciting period at the office. I think it's the most creative and busy time it's ever been. Although we keep our size very small, we're 4 at the moment, we are working on about, I think, 10 projects or more in parallel. Half of them happen to be abroad. I think 5 are projects abroad, and more than 5 are here in Greece.
Greece isn't out of murky waters just yet, but with the country set to welcome a record number of tourists this summer, it seems that the likes of K-Studio and Point Supreme will definitely have their hands full. For Monocle in Athens, I'm Daphne Karnizis.
Many thanks to Daphne Karnizis reporting from Athens. Now, the financial crunch hasn't all been bad news for Greece. It's allowed entrepreneurs to successfully set up unlikely businesses in unsuspecting places. Our correspondent in the capital went to meet a businesswoman who took the risk of opening an upscale designer second-hand boutique in an unexpected corner of Athens. Monocle's Natalie Savarikas reports.
Athens is undergoing a transformation. Foreigners, artists and new businesses are slowly starting to add their own flair to neighbourhoods. Nowhere is this more apparent than in downtown Exarchia, where Mandica Ilic opened her second-hand clothes shop. Hi, Mandica. Tell me a bit about Bobo. What does it mean? What is it? Tell us about the concept.
Bobo, first of all, it comes from Bohemian Bourgeois. That's a name I always liked. I like this kind of living. It's something I always compared myself with. And I started Bobo exactly 10 years ago. The period of time where I thought it's the right time to open a second-hand store, especially designer second-hand, because I used to work many years with models. So anything which has to do with brands, luxury, was always a part of my business life. In my spare time was checking out flea markets, second-hand shops, thrift shops, and designer second-hand, and hoping for the little treasure to find which I can afford.
We're kind of on the border between Kolonaki, which is a more affluent part of Athens, but also Exarchia, which is considered indeed to be the bohemian side, or even like borderline anarchist hub for many. Why here, and how do you feel the reaction has been of the locals?
We are right in the middle, so we can combine the bohemian the adventurous life of Excelsia next to us, which gives us kind of something to be cool and independent. And then having also Kolonaki next door, where they can afford things we are offering. It's just a great mix.
How have you seen the neighborhood change over the course of the years?
It has been always a busy area in terms of anarchists and police and graffiti, and shops were opening, shops were closing. People tried a new business, some new ideas. So it's a standing up community, in my opinion. Small little entrepreneurs which are trying to do something on their own, smart ideas. Even foreign people who move to Athens, they like the area of Exarchia. So I like this mix and match.
How would you say the residents in the neighborhood have reacted to Bobo?
When I had the idea to open a designer secondhand store, I heard from a lot of Greek people, why would you do it? Greeks would not understand it. Nobody would buy used things. It's absolutely not happening. The Greeks love the idea of secondhand by now, and it's also fun for them to sell their things. Through the crisis, it was a great period to see how people would change and adapt the things they have, and then don't know actually what to do with them. So we gave them our platform to sell the items, to make some cash, and also we gave them a platform to find something which they have been dreaming of. So, yes, I think they adapted.
Bobo is not only a fashion mecca for all luxury brand devotees. This two-story neoclassical listed building has been revamped and adds its own distinct and independent mark to Exarchia.
I'm just in love with it because it's from 1870. The building is in such a great condition. It belongs to one of those old buildings which has protection now, so we have to be very careful with interior and what kind of material we choose, because it has to reflect the story of the old building when it was built by then. It was the biggest investment in my life and probably the biggest risk I've ever done business-wise to move in such a building, because the renovation was huge.
How would you describe the design inside?
My architects, we were very much in a common sense to choose something which is simple, clean details, to just be able to expose all those thousands of products we have, because they're all different shapes, colors, designers, and they're unique. So we wanted to give them the presence and the environment they need in order to make them shine. So we reduced the interior in a very clean look, to give the actually goods a nice, refurnished, beautiful surrounding.
In the past 14 years that you've been following the fashion industry in Greece, how would you say it's changed?
I see such a movement of Greek designers, also internationally recognized, Mary Kadratsou, Zeus and Dione, beautiful jewelry designers, amazing jewelry designers. One of my favorite is Lito. And people start to discover the treasures they have actually in their country, and they do something very beautiful, clean, and always with this ancient touch, which makes it so different, with a lot of details in terms of design and material. So yes, I think there's a huge change in Greek fashion, and I hope there's more to come. It's beautiful.
Is Athens the place to be now?
Definitely. My God, guys, move to Athens. I'm telling you, it's the most beautiful city in the world. And yes, I've been traveling a lot, but I would always come back to Athens. It's my hometown. I'm so happy being here, and there's so much to discover.
For Monocle, in Athens, this is Natalie Savarikas.
Now, earlier this year, two mosques in London were given Grade 2 listed status, the highest accolade a building can be granted, which prohibits meddling and acknowledges its importance as a structure. The decision is in part thanks to a book entitled The British Mosque, which chronicles the history and evolution of these structures in the UK. Monocle's Bill Lutie sat down with the book's author, who's also an architect, Shahed Salim.
Fundamentally, the mosque is a place in which congregational prayer takes place, and all it really needs to do is point towards Mecca. Then there'll be a place for ablution, which is the ritual ablution before prayer, and essentially a hall in which people pray. And that's actually all you need for the mosque. So everything else that you see is additional, actually. Could be outside. It's basically a place where a congregation can come together.
And this book is specifically about British mosques.
Yeah.
My dad lives in Woking. When this came up, I was like, hey,
right,
I know where
right,
the first
right.
mosque was built. Yeah. But that's not actually the first mosque in the book.
No. So the first mosque that was established was in Liverpool, and that was in a house that was converted. And that was by an English convert to Islam called William Quilliam. And he converted in the late 19th century, and then he settled in Liverpool, which is where he was from, and established the first house mosque there. So it was a converted house. And that was 1887 to 1889 is when that one started. And then Woking was built in 1889. So Woking was the first purpose-built mosque.
I thought this earlier, like when you're putting a mosque in a building, can you only choose a building that's facing a certain way, or do you just have to kind of move the inside to face east?
The building is already there, so you have to kind of fit yourself within the building. So often you'll get the prayer hall, which will be at a sort of funny angle inside the building, and the lines of prayer will be at an oblique angle of some sort or another. So you see that quite often in mosques in this country because they're sort of adapted into existing buildings. And then there's about 35 or so case studies in the book looking at buildings specifically. I mean, obviously there's 1,600 or 1,700 mosques in this country, so obviously it's not going to be about all of them. but the idea is that through the case studies that I've chosen, what I was trying to do was kind of represent the full range of types of buildings that there are. So there are house mosques, for example, which are houses which have been converted into mosques. That was the earliest type of conversion, which was the easiest thing for communities to do as they settled. The easiest thing was to get a house and just start using it as a prayer space, basically. And then there's larger types of conversion. So that's the second type of mosque that there is, which could be any other building, like warehouses, factories, pubs, other religious buildings, for example. They get converted into mosques. And then there's the new build. So the purpose-built, new-built mosque is the smallest number, and it's the one that's emerged sort of latest. They were happening from the late 60s, actually, in terms of like new builds. They took off really through the sort of 80s and 90s is when you really started to see sort of new built mosques being built in this country.
Okay, and then, you know, that first mosque that was built in Woking, there's a picture in the book. Mm. It looks like what I would think is quite a traditional mosque. Was there anything kind of particularly British about how once they started to pop up more and more around the country? What were the designs? What was the style?
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Woking, I mean, it's interesting you say that it's how you'd imagine a mosque to be, because that is exactly what it was intended to be in a way. So it was built in the late 19th century. And this was this sort of end point of the Victorian period. And there was already this quite well-established genre of Orientalism. And so the East, as it was envisaged at that time, was depicted in many different ways through painting, through literature, and through architecture. And it was quite a particular representation of India or North Africa or the Middle East and so on. And these representations were often quite flamboyant, quite exotic, quite, you know, caricaturesque almost. And Woking Mosque fits into that way of seeing the East or the exotic. So it's kind of got a big domes, it's got a lot of sort of quite floral decoration and so on. So in a way, I actually think that Woking Mosque was very British in the sense that it was very Victorian. It was very much a Victorian way of seeing the world. They did develop through time. So it, throughout the sort of 20th century, there were attempts to create more contemporary interpretations of the mosque. It's through the sort of late 1950s, there was examples in Cardiff. And then there was the Regent's Park Mosque, which was recently listed, and it's just nearby here. Mm-hmm. So there were a handful of examples that were trying to create contemporary examples of Muslim architecture.
And it's down to just kind of the designer, what they decide. Are there any prolific mosque designers from Britain? Or
in Bradford, there's an engineer who has gone into sort of mosque design. His name is Al Samurai. He was born in Iraq and settled here, and he's established his practice here. His own estimates that he's designed something like 70 mosques, mostly around the Midlands and the North, all the way up to Scotland. I think what he did is, in the late 90s when he started, he brought for the mosque communities the vision of something which was authentically Islamic, I think. He came from an Iraqi background. He was sort of steeped in the culture of this great sort of Muslim country, as it were. So he was very familiar with the history and the rules of the Muslim world. And I think what he did is he brought those traditional, almost like authentic ways of building to the UK. And I think a lot of mosque communities took to those ideas. So a lot of his buildings are referencing historical examples of mosques. If you look at them, they're quite traditional in many ways, and he really was sort of celebrating that tradition and history through his buildings.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about it's not just a place, or it can just be a prayer room, it can just be a place for people to meet, but it's not always that. There's loads of different things. How are mosques kind of evolving, and what do people use them for? Isn't just for prayer?
Yeah, there's a lot of development really in mosques as establishments and as community centres. So like you're saying, sort of the earliest ones, which were very simple buildings and very simple institutions, were basically there where people would come and pray. There would might be some other religious classes for children and so on. And as the community grew and became more complex, the needs changed and evolved. And I think the mosques realised that they could be offering a whole range of other services as well to local people. And they started to develop a range of other sort of facilities. And so, for example, counselling services, you know, like you're saying, kitchen, dining halls, sports facilities, clubs for older people and sort of youth clubs and so on and so on. And gradually around the country, they've started to sort of evolve and increase the number of facilities that they provide. And that subsequently has started to have an impact on the types of building that they need. So what you start to see is some mosques emerging as community centres where they have a school, a gym, shops, restaurants, plus the prayer space and so on, community halls that can be rented out. And I think what they're gradually might start to look at also is the way in which they can start to offer facilities to the wider community as well. So there's a kind of diversification in the types of building that we have in the country now.
And talk me through the process of planning to build one. You've done that yourself and designing one. How, it's quite a long process, I'd imagine, but can you just briefly talk me through it? What are the challenges? What are the things you need to consider?
There's a couple of different approaches, I suppose, when you're going from converting an existing building, which has one set of issues in regards to planning and design, to a new build. With conversions, you're essentially looking at what's called in planning a change of use, which fundamentally looks at issues around the impact of that change of use that you're doing. And with mosque or any other place of worship applications, really, the issue is numbers of people who are coming, when are they coming, is there going to be increase in traffic and transport, and is there going to be a sort of a disruption in the local area, and so on and so on. So they're quite pragmatic issues that you deal with when you're looking at converting existing buildings. Other things are to do with, if you're increasing the size of it, then again, is there an impact on the neighbourhood and so on. With some conversions where you might be extending, and certainly with the new builds, there's a different set of issues. Alongside all of those issues, there's another set of issues which is about character and design, and what does the building look like, and what does that do to the character of the neighbourhood, and so on. In the earlier days, the sort of 70s and 80s, there was a bit more reluctance to allow buildings which looked very kind of culturally different. There was a bit more sort of hesitancy from planners and from local people about buildings which really sort of represented a very different kind of culture in the environment. I think that's gradually shifted. In many cases, local authorities actually quite welcome a building which is reflective of the diversity and sort of multicultural nature of the community. As with the Hindu temples, like the Nizan one, for example, it actually, you know, buildings like that actually sort of are quite good to sort of demonstrate the diversity in a neighbourhood.
That was Shahed Salim, author of The British Mosque, which is out now and published by Historic England. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, you can always uncover more design stories in the pages of Monocle magazine, our manifold travel guides, our many printed newspapers, and of course at monocle.com. This show was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Ta-ta.